hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is the podcast of free minds, free markets, and free takes. I am your host, Peter Suderman. Happy Monday to everyone who's already filed their tax returns, or maybe not, depending on how big that check was. Today, I am joined by my illustrious colleagues, Matt Welch and Nick Gillespie. Gentlemen, say hi.
Hi.
Hello.
All right, so we also have a very special guest, star of many, many screens, so many screens, Mary Catherine Hamm. Thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Mary Catherine, before we recorded this, I was actually thinking about what I think was the first time we met like 20 years ago now.
Probably. It
had to have been just about 20 years ago because I was working as an editor at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI, and I knew who you were when you showed up at the office because this was 2005, 2006, and you were already doing online video. This was like YouTube was barely a year old, but like you're like the OG of doing online video. Here we are still 20 years later. We have finally caught up with you. Do you have lessons, tips for success?
My lesson is, had I stuck with my YouTube channel, I'd probably be a lot better off now. But I, being me, was like, this is very hard. Video editing is terrible. And kind of abandoned that at some point. And now it's so easy to make video, it almost makes me angry thinking about how much I did back then.
Don't be angry about this. Be happy that you were there.
Prosperity, I know.
At the
technology,
beginning.
Innovation, yes. It's good.
As a University of Georgia person, can we hold you personally accountable for Herschel Walker?
Just going straight
in
there.
In which sense is the question?
I feel like
as a USFL running back,
emerging after his relatively disappointing NFL career into politics is part of the reason we have so many problems today.
As a college running back, you may hold me responsible.
Okay.
That
so
I had much to do with.
So that's what we can hold you responsible for in terms of sports. What about in terms of politics? What's your fault? How do you describe yourself politically? We're all libertarians here. So what do you think you are?
I think I'm a libertarian leaning conservative. I'm a big fan of Reason.
Thank you.
And I enjoy all of y'all's work. And I think if I had my druthers, if I could wave a magic wand, I'd be like, let's eliminate like 75% of the federal government. That's now I can't run for office, by the way, it's on record. But I think that's what I would like. And I think that is what would help people. And also, I realize I can't get that. And so I do, to some extent, I think more than libertarians exist within the lame two-party system and attempt to convince the various parties to do things that are more likely to be the things that I want them to do or closer approximations thereof. And it's not all that successful, I gotta tell you. It's not all that edifying. And then there's the other part, which is that I realize that a bunch of voters in this country are not ideological like myself or like you guys. And that sometimes I wish
possibly
they
also
were.
Some politicians these days,
right.
Not exactly. So ideological.
So I wish they were sometimes more consistently ideological, but I have to go to war with the electorate I have versus the one I wish for, and that means attempting to convince people on various topics. Sometimes it works. I think school choice is a great example of a place where convincing people has worked, that the government is failing you in this area and giving you more choices and more power and taking it away from them is the thing that will help your children. But other times it doesn't work at all, like on the debt. Or general spending. So that's where I am.
All right. That sounds like a good place to be. It sounds like a good foundation for a productive discussion. You should be on the Reason Roundtable, and here you are. We have a great show coming up. We're going to talk about Trump's tariffs turnaround, markets getting yippy, trade war with China, tax day gripes, and what this tax day means for the federal budget. Latest on Doge savings. Have we saved $2 trillion yet? Doesn't seem like it. Doesn't seem like Mary Catherine's getting her cut 75% of the budget here. Maybe not happening. Plus our cultural recommendations and so much more. But let's start once again with Donald Trump and trade. It increasingly looks like President Donald Trump is the Mr. Miyagi of trade policy. Tariffs on, tariffs off, tariffs on, tariffs off. Last week, Trump announced a pause on most of the reciprocal tariffs he had previously announced, while still leaving a baseline of 10% tariffs that Trump advisors say is definitely not going away. We'll see about that. But he didn't pause the tariffs on China. On the contrary, trade levies with China have only gone up. This is a couple of days ago, so literally it could be out of date by the time you hear this, or even by the time I'm reading it this morning. But tariffs on Chinese products went from 54% at the beginning of April to 145% last week. Chinese government responded last Friday by raising its own tariffs on American goods to 125%. This now looks like a full-blown trade war. Nick, I'm going to start with you. Is this the hard decoupling from China that the hawks have long dreamed of?
No. And also, by the way, a hard decoupling from China, I think, would be stupid. But for me, what stuck out beyond the, you know, the kind of wax on, wax off stuff with the tariffs in general is that Trump, after saying there were no exceptions for China, also did create exemptions for products or things used by Apple, NVIDIA, Tesla, even Temu and Shine, which had been a target before because they ship directly to Americans. And as long as the cost is under $800, they don't get hit with the same kind of tariff fees.
Even they were exempted. Do you know how much Temu $800 would buy you?
Oh, I know. It's like you would buy the entire like new greenhouse that you can live in.
Yeah. And then, I don't have the square footage for what you could buy.
It's truly amazing. It's truly
amazing.
I also wonder
a row when house people shipped like, to you on Temu.
You see like Temu baby strollers and stuff, and it's like, who is doing that? Unless you are buying that for the person you hate the most, like who would ever put a kid in anything made by Temu? But about 22% of goods, you know, by volume that are coming from China have been exempted, according to Reuters and a couple of other places. So, you know, this is a fake trade war, and it's clear that Donald Trump doesn't know what he's doing. He thought that all he had to do was snap his fingers and tariffs would, you know, somehow magically bring everybody to America, to their knees in front of America. The markets would love it, et cetera. And the only person he has convinced that he has some kind of multidimensional chess playing abilities is Bill Ackman, who is a sad sack of shit.
That seems maybe a little over the top, maybe even a lot over the top. What? Mary Catherine,
I'm being compared to people like Cliff Asness, another big, billionaire investor. I'm being quite nice to Bill Ackman. Asness notoriously said that he, that the whole point of having fuck you money is that you don't have to put on a gimp suit for somebody else.
Loved that scene in Pulp Fiction, but doesn't need to be at the White House. Mary Catherine, where are you at on Trump's tariffs? You've got all these arguments for them, right? Trump officials say they're going to create jobs. They're going to make America an industrial power again. They're going to protect national security, all these great things, just everything wonderful in the world. Are you seeing any upside?
I don't like them. I don't like them, guys. Yeah. As I called myself on TV the other day, I'm like a medium panican, I would say, to borrow the president's terminology, because there is damage just in uncertainty. This is what businesses rely on. If they don't know the rules of the game, they don't know what they can invest in. They don't know what they should invest in. I don't like the idea of one dude micromanaging the global economy. That is against every economic wisdom we have, that should work well and be prosperous for people. I don't think he has the emergency powers to do this. And I am post-COVID very wary of people using emergency powers for things they don't have the power to do. I understand, once again, that voters are less ideological than I am on this subject. And they feel that him putting tariffs on China in particular, I think with the other stuff, I don't understand why Mexico, why Canada, there's so much less appetite for that. With China in particular, there are people who think this is like how he's fighting for us. He is going to change the economic landscape of the United States of America. I don't think that's true. I don't think that can happen, certainly not quickly. And then what he does is he sort of changes his rationalization for it, as do the people who are arguing for the tariffs, by saying, and by the way, I don't think he minds, because he both loves tariffs and loves negotiating with people. So if he gets the tariffs to stay, he's like, tariffs are great. If the tariffs have to be removed because people get yippy, and I think that was his admission that he's switching plans because people got upset, then he gets to make 170 plus bilateral trade deals, which is another thing he would love to do. I would note that there are no trade deals done at the moment, And with a country like Vietnam, which is like, we'll give you this and this, you could have had that deal if you had just said yes to TPP in 2017.
Yeah. We had trade deals. This is the thing. Although everybody who's like Trump's going to bring people to the table to negotiate trade deals. Yeah. We had them. Trump blew them up.
Yeah. So that and I think that's partly just because the man who is president wants to be the one who negotiates all of them. So he needs to get to work if that's the plan. But I don't think it's ultimately going to serve the American people in the ways that he's advertising. And I worry very much about what people are losing in the exchange, even though I do think there are sort of ethical and practical concerns with Chinese products, baby carriers in particular, maybe, and the way that the economy runs in China and how much we depend on various things, as we saw sort of some with the supply lines during COVID. I just don't think this is the solution.
Matt, let's follow up on that. China does seem to be the real focus here, both for the actual tariffs and also a lot of the Trump supporters, the MAGA types who've been sort of pushing for this for a long time. And they make a couple of arguments. One is that, you know, when we opened up trade with China, that did not bring about the kind of political liberalization that was predicted in the 1990s. They also say, and this is their argument, so not mine that I'm making, but I think, you know, we need to sort of talk through their arguments. They say it helped hollow out the middle class in the United States, in particular by deindustrialization and destroying a lot of the kinds of jobs that like non-college educated men in the Midwest might have had. And they also say it made us weaker just generally as a nation by reducing our manufacturing capacity. Do you agree with any of this? Like, are they getting any of this story right?
So like, I'm not a trade economist for a living necessarily. I think that when you look at the shift in American workforce over time, and you put a line on a chart, and you can have different little points of interest, you know, admitting China into the WTO, signing NAFTA, these kinds of things, they don't really affect the trajectory of the line, of the nature of the workforce, what percentage of Americans work in manufacturing, which is what right now the pro-tariff side is exalting that type of work. That percentage hasn't really been affected, the trajectories of those one way or the other, I don't think, by trade deals with China and whatever. I think China will politically liberalize if we admit them into the nation or the family of nations that trade with one another. I think that's a bit oversold. Perhaps it was oversold at the time by people who were enthusiasts, but I think there's a bit of rewriting of history that's going on here. I don't think the huge promise is like, we're going to defeat communism by having a trade agreement with China. I think it's more like you want poor authoritarian countries to come more into the international rules-based system that America wrote, more or less, at the time, that will be better. There'll be less poverty, less starvation. Nick and I are the only ones old enough here to remember they're starving back in China. So finish what you got. They're not starving anymore in China. That's just a generational change. And that's good. We don't want human beings to starve. If you want to isolate China, I was someone who was not in favor of going as fast into trade agreements with China as we did. I didn't think that they should be admitted to the WTO, because in a rules-based order, you need countries that are actually following the rules. And there's been plenty of indication over time, particularly on software and intellectual property, and other things that we care about in trade negotiations in America, that China was a bad actor. And I thought that was premature to put them in, as it was premature to put in, I don't know why I'm doing that, to put in like Russia into the G20 or the G7 plus one. Russia was not ready to go that place as well. If you want to, if you share that belief and you want to isolate China and you worry about China being aggressive, sort of militarily and diplomatically in the world, what is the best way to go about it? In my mind, the best way to go about it, if you're in Trump's shoes, is to say, hey, look, Americans, what we're doing right now is we're sort of doing a long-term recalibration. We are in a superpower rivalry with China. So that he's in this agreeing with those 1990s neocons that he otherwise tries to trash, because they were very obsessed with pivoting to China back then. What you want to do is you want to negotiate with all the other countries to isolate China. And instead, what you did with the rest of the countries is you slapped 10% import tax on all their goods coming here, and you acted like a jerk. So those countries are not in the mood to cooperate with America on anything, let alone isolating China. So I think even if this is all your goal, and I agree with all of it, let's say I do, this is not the way to go about it.
I think we're all breathing a sigh of relief, though, that Lesotho is no longer dicking us over, Matt.
That's right.
When it comes
enough.
To trade. And, you know, Madagascar, which may or may not still be the Malagasy Republic. No more. I'm with Trump. On standing up to these monsters.
Okay, well, if you're with Trump on standing up to these monsters, do you think, let's talk about like whether or not this is going to work. I think Matt's sort of taking us in the right direction here, because one of the things we saw over the weekend or last week is that there were reports that the EU is maybe gearing up to do some trade agreements with China, that this is actually going to strengthen the links between China and the rest of the world. We have this supposed hard decoupling, except there are all these carve-outs now, these exceptions for phones and computer chips, possibly some other computer goods, some other consumer goods, I should say. Although Trump denies this. He posted this weekend, there was no tariff exception announced on Friday. Well, okay, if that's what the president says, but the White House did put out a press release with the headline, Clarification of Exceptions. Under Executive Order 14257, yeah. Right? And it's all about the reciprocal tariff agreements. So, it
which
sort of
are
seems
not
to me like,
reciprocal, but yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Which are also not reciprocal and based on like total math errors and misunderstanding of how trade works. So, Nick, like, just on its own terms, do you see this working in any way? Do you see this as strengthening America's position vis-a-vis our sort of major global rival?
No. I mean, I think if Xi is smart, what he'll say is, you know what, Trump, you clearly won the 2020 election and you had a gigantic inaugural crowd in 2017. So why don't we just drop tariffs on Chinese imports to zero? We'll still tariff you coming into the U.S., but that'll be fine, right? No, I think, and for the points that you were kind of implying, Peter, and Matt was talking about the TPP, which was under consideration when Trump first ran for president, was a really good idea. Like, if you're concerned about China becoming too big in terms of global trade and whatnot, you know, and it was clear, I know I've mentioned this a bunch of times, but during one of the candidate debates during the 2016 campaign, the way Trump was talking about TPP, it was clear he did not realize that China was not part of it. And Rand Paul corrected him from the stage. And that kind of tells you everything you need to know about what Trump understands about tariffs. Without becoming, you know, turning everything into a shitty psychodrama, I think what we're what we're seeing here is, you know, Trump's narcissism, like eventually narcissists run, you know, they either completely dominate the world around them and they're like little atmospheric bubble, or they go too far and then they meet people who are not invested in pretending that their version of the world is reality. And that's what's happening here. Whatever happens in the long run, anything that does end up being accomplished could have been accomplished without, you know, a massive hiccup in markets and this projection or injection of uncertainty into it. If you go to the St. Louis Fed's uncertainty index for economic policy in the U.S. and the world, we are at levels that are beyond, you know, what we were seeing during the pandemic. This is a completely Trump-generated psychodrama, and it's not good. And however it ends, it is completely unnecessary. Last week, I was likening, and Matt, I suspect you might enjoy this, I was likening Trump to Demi Moore in St. Elmo's Fire.
Oh.
You know, and there's a scene when, you know, Rob Lowe explains the metaphor of St. Elmo's Fire and about how Demi Moore's character, and she was, I believe, still Demi Moore. She had not yet become Demi Moore. But you know, like it's just these self-imposed dramas to give your life meaning. It's tedious, it's awful, and ultimately it's ruinous of an America, you know, that we want to believe in. Let's get the economy moving forward rather than constantly being jerked around like a yo-yo on Trump's finger.
Well, my question about him too is that is he trying to solve the problem in quotes of trade deficits? Is that because that feels like where he's going sometimes?
That he's explicitly
like,
said that.
Like trade deficits are inherently a problem and we must solve them with every country. But that makes no sense because you shouldn't be in trade parity with a country much smaller that makes different products than you do. And the beauty of a global market is that you can trade in different places and it all sort of evens out. Like I take his point about unfair practices in some areas, as you pointed out, Matt, the admission of China to the World Trade Organization, all those kinds of things are valid points and something I think Americans care about. I'm sort of a relative on this where I prefer the posture of the moment where at least there's an attempt to hammer China versus people who might be more willing to move into our sphere, but I don't know if it's going to work. But as I tell people, like, I have a trade deficit with Bojangles because they have great biscuits and they don't need my podcasting skills yet. But that's not inherently bad. I'm getting a product I want and I'm able to sell my wares elsewhere. So if we're trying to solve for that, that's not a good thing to be solving for. And I think it will lead to bad results unless he just loses interest and moves on to.
And also to that point, the other big thing supposedly that, you know, this is going to help. Is the hollowing out of the middle class or the decline of living standards in America. And over the period of time when we've ramped up trade with China and increased globalization, you know, at the end of the 90s when the WTO was created and there were all those globalization protests and whatnot, the fact of the matter is when you take out the financial crisis and COVID, which are government create, well, the reaction to COVID, government created hiccups in the economy in a profound way. What you see is that real median income, real median household income continues to go up and it's at the level that it was before COVID and can keep going forward. There is no hollowing out of the American middle class. Manufacturing as a percentage of the economy, the number of workers in it has declined, but so have farmers because we do things that are have more value added to them and that pay better. And so the idea that, you know, as Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, was jawing about a week ago about how, like, you know, it's going to be great in America is that your grandkids will be screwing the tiny screws into iPhones. Finally, you know, we can come back to doing assembly line work that is miserable and doesn't pay very well. And that's a fantasy, but it's unnecessary. The economy, the American economy is better than it was in 2000 for virtually all workers. And that's a win. That's not something to be fixed.
It's also worth pointing out that right now, I think the manufacturing sector says that it is suffering through a labor market. They want to fill 500,000 jobs that they cannot currently fill. And labor is one of the chief complaints of that industry. So we could be doing more here already, given the rules that we have.
So there's a different version of that argument that Nick was talking about, that this is about the hollowing out of the middle class, that uses that idea as an excuse for ignoring the market's reaction. So anybody who has looked at their retirement account or just read the front page of the Wall Street Journal or checked a stock ticker over the last 2 weeks or so has seen these gigantic fluctuations. And it's like one day you've got a retirement account and the next day you kind of don't have one. And maybe, again, by the time we're done with this podcast, it'll be back and forth several more times. And you've got Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, who is, I think, the most sophisticated of Trump's economic advisors, at least of the folks who have been going on television and talking about this in public. And he says, right, so the top 10% own most of the stock market, the next 40% down own like the rest of the stock market, and the bottom 50% of the country, they've got debt. They don't have an ownership stake in the economy, and the tariffs give them relief. So, Mary Catherine, I want to ask you about this, because this is an argument that the tariffs are basically good for sort of lower income earners, and particularly the kind of like, right, like the Trump coalition of non-college educated, non-urban, rural families who have been struggling in the heartland, particularly sort of in the Rust Belt. Like, you're a a conservative, you're a libertarian leaning conservative. I assume like you think there's something to like, hey, maybe America should care about those people. Do you
yes.
think that this is a way of like, to be clear, I think we all think America should care about those people, but like this is, right, this is an argument that has become more right-coded and sort of more Republican over the last, since Trump entered politics. Do you see that as a sort of coherent argument that actually, like, it does, the stock market fluctuations don't matter because half the country isn't invested there?
Well, there are a lot of people invested in the stock market, even if they are middle class through various mechanisms, even if they're not tracking it all the time. But look, I think it's very important to listen to the concerns of those voters and to care about those communities, some of which I have lived and worked in before I came to D.C. One of them in particular in North Carolina was in what they call the poverty belt, right on the South Carolina, North Carolina line, where all the textile mills left. And it was left bereft for quite some time. What is interesting to me is that I have been back there many times to visit. And on its surface, it looks much more prosperous than it did during the time of the textile mills and briefly after when they left town. In globalization, right? There are more chain restaurants. There are more things to do. There are more public parks. There is also more of an opioid problem, significantly, than there was back then. So I think we have an issue of prosperity, but not necessarily fulfillment in these communities. And there is a nostalgia for something that was before that maybe was not as perfect as people are remembering it now through rose-colored glasses, but that it is a yearning that needs to be addressed by politicians and needs to be addressed by policy. I don't think this is the way to do it. But what people are hearing from Trump is that he's fighting for me. He cares about communities like mine. He cares about the fact that we feel bad about where we've gone. And you can see that in polling. There was a CNN segment with Harry Enten the other day where he was just mystified that the GOP's numbers on you care about problems of people like me is higher than it's been in decades. And I think that part of this pitch is why. So being cognizant of those problems and trying to solve them is good. I do not think that this is the way to do it. I think that the free market in general makes all of us more prosperous and that fulfillment, which I think is the actual problem, is not a government problem that we're going, it's not yeah, something we're going to solve with government.
You don't want politics determining meaning in life, right? And this is the thing. We have what I call the agony of abundance, where it's more of us have to create meaning in our lives on a daily basis because we've been liberated from, you know, basic material concerns. That's hard work. And we have not, as a culture and as a society, we haven't educated ourselves on how to do that. We don't even do it well among, you know, eggheads, and, you know, double and triple degreed people graduating from universities. It's hard work, but it's not going to be solved by, you know, Donald Trump Jr. or Eric or shitcoins or Elon Musk or anything like that. It's something different. And the thing, you know, at rock bottom, finally, it's like Trump loves, you know, lower income people so much. He is making everything that they consume more expensive.
Well,
what a
and
gift.
This is the problem,
what a
right?
gift.
Is that you? If you have a fulfillment issue, not necessarily a prosperity issue, although there are certainly people suffering, I don't discount that. But in general, with our quality of living, just wait until you take away the cheap products and people realize how much they liked the ability to have those. One of the I can't remember who posted. I believe it was a Vox writer, but wrote a really nice essay about how
Kelsey
having,
Piper.
Yes, how having cheap products allows you to try a new hobby, to let your kid try something out that in the past would have been cost prohibitive, that you're not putting huge outlays on these new things that you get to try that add spice and variety and meaning sometimes to your life because you have all of these things available to you. And once that's gone, I think people will not be upset and will not be happy about that.
I think there's one element of this that is worth thinking about in the spirit that Mary Catherine especially is talking about. Whenever there is a concentration of a certain type of industry, you see this weekend, you know, Donald Trump's talking about the coal miners. We talk about auto workers. We've talked in the past about textile mills. Where I'm from, it's aerospace industry, which lost like 200,000 jobs in a hurry in the 1990s in Southern California. People take a lot of meaning and pride in working in certain sectors, and there's a cultural identity associated with that. And when those sectors break up, those people who are affected by it don't deserve sneering contempt. And I think part of what Donald Trump has kind of introduced, especially to a in American politics where Democrats have drifted more towards the educated and professionalized classes, is I don't have contempt for you over there at all. I agree with the assembled room that his policies are not great for that, particularly when you think of in terms of pensions. I mean, these jobs that you're talking about and that you're even romanticizing right now, all of those jobs have some kind of pension. All of those pensions are in the stock market. There is, you might not think about it. You're not yourself like day trading or anything like that. But if you have a pension, that pension's in the stock market, and that stock market has lost 7% of value since Trump was inaugurated. And that is not a small thing. We've survived stretches, George W. Bush presidency, the stock market was down. It's not everything, but it is a thing. And we shouldn't pretend that we shouldn't wave our hands away from that, while at the same time, we should have respect and empathy for people's sense of attaching dignity to their work.
Is there a small part of this that can be solved with policy, which is making sure that those manufacturing jobs we actually do have can be filled by people, that we could incentivize the proper pipelines for that? This is sort of the micro model of saying, like, let's treat with dignity people working with their hands and make sure that young people understand this is a path that they can take and how to take it and get into those jobs. I mean, that's like I love a small policy. Let's bite off
perhaps,
something little that we can maybe
perhaps
do.
There is something that could be done, say, with education reform, yes. Both in terms of policy and cultural expectations.
Yeah, but, but a lot of this is also, it isn't about education. You know, think about Springfield, Ohio, which came into the news because J.D. Vance lied about Haitians, Haitians who were there under temporary protected status legally were eating cats and dogs. And as that story kind of evolved, it turned out Haitians were brought there by Ohio is a big, which I know very well. I lived there for 20 years in small town Ohio in the 90s and 2000s. They were brought there by jobs that were being offered by auto parts manufacturers. And the people who own those factories said that these Haitians, zombies who were stitching baseballs a generation ago, somehow show up without even speaking proper English, show up and work and do well there. And there are tons of native-born Ohioans who are there, who are literally in the same town, who were not showing up. These are the people that J.D. Vance railed against in his in Hillbilly Elegy. And now suddenly, once he's in political power, he's saying, no, you know what, it's systemic. And somehow these people from other places and China and whatnot, there's a whole system against the people that he said had weak character when he was writing Hillbilly Elegy. And now he says, we need to block the borders. We need to block, of goods and services and of people, and then focus on helping these people. It's, and I have nothing but empathy for people who are struggling to get out of a lower middle class or a paycheck to paycheck lifestyle. But we need to be realistic. Most factory jobs now, you will do on the job training. Things like, being a plumber, being an electrician, there are apprenticeships that are involved in that. And certainly all sorts of business regulations could be reduced and you could have better vo-tech programs, which have gone out of fashion. But right now, there are hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs that are going unfilled. None of them are the type of thing where you've got to go to you've got to go to shop class for 6 years before you can walk in the factory and start doing it.
There was a survey that came out from Frank Luntz here just recently, asked Americans, America would be better off if more people were working in manufacturing. And 80% of Americans said America would be better off with more people working in manufacturing. And then they were asked, would you be better off if you worked in a factory? And only 25% of them agreed. And so this, I think, is part of the disconnect. This is a good political message. Trump says things like, I'm proud to be the president for the workers, not the outsourcers. President who stands up for Main Street, not Wall Street, right? Blah, blah, the middle class, not the political class. But then when you actually get down to brass tacks and are required to make that choice, most people don't want those jobs. And the idea that having those jobs is going to give you meaning and that that's the government's job, I think, is the worst part of this. Like in some ways, the economics of it are all wrong, right? The sort of the tariff defenders, like they just get all of this stuff wrong. But this idea that it's going to bring people meaning, it's not just I think empty and wrongheaded. It's antithetical to what America stands for. The greatest sort of like mission statement for America is that we're for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It's the pursuit of happiness, not guaranteed happiness, not guaranteed meaning. It's that the job of the government is there to carve out space for you to find that on your own. The other job of the government, and this is our transition here, is to collect money from you, whether or not you want to give it to them. It's time to pay your taxes. Tuesday is tax day. We're recording this on Monday, April 14th. Many of you will be listening to this on Tuesday, April 15th, which means you have to send a big check to the IRS if you haven't paid them already. Are you getting any value for that money? There's that old quote about how tax is the price we pay for civilization. But are all of your tax dollars really leading to a more civilized world? I want to ask all of our panelists here to bring one thing that you dislike that is funded by American tax dollars. Matt Welch, let's start with you.
So Nick Gillespie and I have made the potentially awful decision, but also great decision to live in New York City, which is one of the few cities in the union that also has an income tax. And it's not insubstantial. So a couple of days ago, we got flyers with a little helpful compost cop on it, yeah, saying, if you're is your building not composting, because we have a tip line here, we will do a mandatory like fines and all of this stuff. So
it's like COVID but for composting,
in New York City. Do you guys know how New York works? You don't live in big places, and there's a lot of rats. Yeah. Like, what are we doing here? So this drives me
the
to distraction.
Rats,
edible
Matt,
garbage,
the best rats.
It makes me want to not do terrorism, but just have like little fantasies about Quentin Tarantino making a movie about compost cops.
Revenge is always bad unless you're the Punisher. Mary Catherine, what do you hate that the IRS takes your money to fund?
Ones?
Yeah.
Can I do two quick ones? One, because there's so many to choose from. One, that public labor unions get to get paid to do their electioneering and bargaining on the job occasionally, and not even just occasionally. There's actually an Examiner editorial about it this week where they've racked up like millions of dollars, of course, in costs to taxpayers, because written into their collective bargaining, which now Trump has said maybe you guys shouldn't have the power to do that, is the ability to do union related work while they're on their job. And that just doesn't make any sense, because public labor unions literally argue against us. We are the taxpayers, we are paying them. They shouldn't have the power to do that with us. So that's one thing. And then the other one was, I know you guys have seen the coverage because it's always very dramatic about any cut to National Park Service. I love national parks. They're one of my favorite parts of the federal government. So let me just put that out there. However, the drama when this happens is not real, because the money that goes to national parks has gone, oh yes, I checked, according to the Congressional Research Service, up over the last decade in nominal and inflation adjusted dollars. And then I looked up another part, which is that the Great American Outdoors Act, passed in 2020, was to spend $2 billion a year on national parks on only deferred maintenance. Now, deferred maintenance is something that's in a backlog that the government should have fixed before, but they're so bad at fixing things, they didn't fix it. So they're like, let's come up with a new budget just for deferred maintenance. $2 billion a year since 2020. Would you like to imagine whether there's more deferred maintenance now or less than there was at the beginning of this program?
Mm-hmm. You want to tell us? I don't know the answer here.
They've started and almost completed 8% of the projects that were on the list. And actually, due to their calculations, the list has grown. So this is the perfect example of how, even in a place that I like to spend money theoretically, they do it so badly and so disrespectfully that I just want them cut off and not hanging their upside down flags on Half Dome or whatever that was when they did that stunt earlier this year.
I think I must have missed that one. Nick, what do you have for us?
I'm going with a big price tag. It's Medicare Part D, the prescription drug benefits that both George W. Bush and Al Gore campaigned on saying we need prescription drug benefits for seniors because they're choosing between eating, eating food and cat food and their pills. Al Gore famously and hilariously talked about how his mother had to make these kinds of decisions. And it's like, Al Gore, you're a fucking millionaire based on Earth in the Balance or whatever, An Inconvenient Truth, all this kind of stuff. And you won't let your, you won't buy your mom McDonald's and throw it out the window when you drive by her double wide or something like that. Medicare Part D will cost $137 billion in 2025. It's 15% of all Medicare costs. It is 75% of that comes from general revenue. So it's not paid for through Medicare payroll taxes or premiums. Three quarters of it is it comes out of general revenue, taxpayer money. The kicker here is on July 7th, 2000, you can look it up at Reason, Catherine Mangan Ward, then an intern, now the editor-in-chief of all she surveys in the editorial realms at Reason, wrote up a study from the CBO that found that seniors then were spending 3.7% of their annual income on drugs, including prescription drugs. To put that in perspective, they spent 5.3% on entertainment. This is the definition of something, of an entitlement that was unnecessary but made great politics. I think Medicare Prescription Part D, it pisses me off because there are people who need help. And I think, I'm willing to say that the government should help out people, with a safety net, people who cannot provide for basic necessities. Medicare Prescription Part D is, takes that logic and rams a truck-sized hole through the logic of that and just costs everybody more and more money for no good reason.
That goes, I think, to a part of our discourse that really irritates me, which is like, if we don't have a government program for this, if we don't have a federal department of X, then how will people get X? If we don't have a federal department of education, then will anybody learn anything ever? If we don't have a Medicare prescription drug program, then how will seniors get their drugs? In fact, these things didn't exist for most of America's history, and people did manage to get drugs before Medicare Part D, and there was even education before the Department of Education. I will just end this segment by noting, by tying the first two segments together here, noting, according to the Tax Foundation, this is, I believe, from April 9th, so it's this came before some of the reversals of the tariffs, but if you go back and look at the tariffs that were announced and that went into effect, at least briefly, the tariffs represent the largest tax increase since 1982. We'll take average tax rates on imports to 1930s levels while shrinking the U.S. GDP by about 0.8%. And that's before the retaliation is factored in. Obviously, with all the reversals, like these numbers, may not be quite current. But like, if you hate taxes, if you are annoyed by having to send the IRS a giant check every year, you should also feel the same way about tariffs. All right, we are going to come back with a listener question in just a moment. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Want to give a student the mindset of a founder? Join the 2025 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago, July 26th through August 2nd. Designed for students aged 16 to 24, this week-long experience builds the core skills of entrepreneurship, critical thinking, persuasive communication, and intellectual independence. This year's theme, Reason and Free Will, explores great minds like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Thomas Jefferson, not through lectures, but in dynamic, small group discussions that train students to lead and innovate. Outside the classroom, they'll tour Chicago's museums, try improv comedy, and connect with ambitious peers. In a world of AI and automation, original thinking is your competitive edge. Tuition is just $800, including room and board. Scholarships are available. Apply today at www.reliancecollege.org/reason. That's www.reliancecollege.org/reason. All right. Our listener question comes from Jonathan in Calgary, who writes, Hi, Reason Roundtable. I've been reading through Thomas Jefferson's list of grievances, and I have to wonder, does this hit a little close to home when thinking about Trump's presidency or the possible shape of a second term? And this is a quote from Thomas Jefferson, who we've already quoted once on this podcast. He has refused to assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people. He has obstructed the administration of justice by refusing to assent to laws for establishing judiciary powers, for cutting off our trade with all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us, in many cases, of the benefits by trial by jury for transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses. So the question here is, could you imagine Jefferson watching Trump's trade policy, his approach to executive authority, or even the legal drama around his trials and thinking, yeah, this aligns with the spirit of 1776. Should we take this sort of thing more seriously when evaluating how far we have drifted from the founding vision? This question writer also writes that he hates pigeons, but sorry, Nick, Chesterton's fences are always worth thinking about. Maybe we should even rename this one Jefferson's Fence. Nick, since you're name checked, how do you feel about Jefferson's fence and how it applies to Donald Trump?
It's worth remembering that in a very significant way, the American Revolution was fought over tariffs and import.
They were taxing
and export duties
tea.
And things like that. So, yeah. So thank you. Although if he sounds like he's from Canada, so, you know, let's discount that by 20%.
I think we're going to. Yeah, I actually have to. Tariff that by 20%, but all right. Mary Catherine, what do you think? Jefferson on Donald Trump?
Yeah, look, we've drifted so far that, again, I'm sort of a relativist when it comes to this stuff. And I think many people saw Donald Trump, particularly post-COVID when they had lost faith in a lot of institutions, as just a rebuke to those institutions. And to some extent, possibly a correction or a check to illiberalism from the left. But the tool sometimes is illiberalism from the right. Not all the time with all of his policies. Some of them might be good in here, like sprinkled in there. And I appreciate actually not a small amount of them when it comes to things like an occasional executive order that I think is doing the right thing and sending power elsewhere, or the idea that the Department of Education could be much, much smaller, if not non-existent at all. But like the thing about Trump is that he doesn't believe any of those things. He just incidentally stumbles upon them. But I think in my calculation, when I looked at those two options during 2024, it looked like people were being offered like a 1990s Democrat. And Vance is actually very indicative of that with his positions on trade and all sorts of things versus a 2025 Democrat. And like in my book, the 1990s Democrat is preferable to the 2025 Democrat if you're given those two choices. And I don't always make a decision between those two, and I'll write somebody in. But no, I don't think Jefferson would be pleased, just as I, an ideological person, think we've drifted so very far. But I must deal with what I am given.
Matt Welch, thoughts on Thomas Jefferson and Donald Trump, or perhaps Jefferson Airplane and Donald Trump?
As I'm going to just pass that one over, as listeners are no doubt fatigued by, I've been marinating in a lot of Revolutionary War era content, books and miniseries and documentaries and stuff. And it is absolutely striking. Absolutely striking to consume that stuff in light of current governance and politics coming from Washington. The amount of almost obsession with avoiding the trappings of monarchy, of submitting to the rule of law, not the whims of a single person, of a mad king imposing blockades on a productive port in Boston. There are many moments, certainly in George Washington's life as a commander in chief of the forces, where he could have gone the monarch way. Sort of misquoting Quentin Tarantino again here. He could have gone the monarch way. It would have been a shortcut to a thing that he wanted, and he chose not to do it. Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, they were obsessed with and worried about, like, we need to build safeguards because there's going to be a temptation in a Republican democracy when people get frustrated to get a new mad king who rails against elites. We're going to see this happen. So what can we do to build guardrails? So yes, Jonathan, despite your Canadian handicap, you are absolutely correct. And I really welcome everybody, since we're up against the 250th anniversary, I think, of Paul Revere's ride even this month. All those things are starting to happen. go back and check out your Nick Gillespie 1776 musicals and develop some sustenance of the absolutely anti-monarchical sentiment that was everywhere in the Revolutionary War and the founding generation.
It is really remarkable that all of this is coming from the folks who were so mad about the 1619 project that they developed their own counter project designed to sort of restore the true idea of American history and what the founders actually wanted for America. And if you look at what the founders wanted for America, it was really not this. They just specifically did not like tariffs like as a policy, but they also didn't, as Matt said, like the idea of kings, of people whose whims we had to depend on individually. And now you've got sophisticated people in the White House, in Trump's orbit, saying that we need a much more executive, a much more energized executive, right? Really like coming back and saying that what we need to fix the problems in America is a much more empowered president who is more king-like. The White House is tweeting king memes, which is about as serious as they get about anything. But they're not doing it like ironically, like, hey, we're like, it's like, hey, Trump is kind of the king here in a way that is just really disturbing. And also just remarkably antithetical to the idea that like we're going to retake and like go back to the founder's vision. This isn't the founder's vision. Okay, so as a reminder, we love to answer your questions. To submit yours, send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcast@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. For our final block here of news, we're going to check in on Doge. When Doge was announced last year, we started with the idea that it was going to bring us $2 trillion in promised savings. That's a lot, trillions of dollars. And then they were like, okay, maybe we're not going to quite get to $2 trillion. It's going to be $1 trillion. All right, still, that's a lot of money, $1 trillion. And now, according to Elon Musk himself, it's going to be $150 billion. So that's 15% of the reduced goal that had already been reduced by 15%. And that's only going to happen by October 2026. That's next fiscal year. And maybe we won't even get that, because according to the New York Times this weekend, when Mr. Musk's group tallies up its savings so far, it inflates its progress by including billion-dollar errors, by counting spending that will not happen in the next fiscal year, and by making guesses about spending that might not happen at all. So Matt, I want to just ask you, Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal last year, and one of the lines in it was, "Skeptics question how much federal spending Doge can tame through executive action alone." Were the skeptics maybe right?
Sadly, because I didn't want them to be right. Let's keep in mind what $150 billion is. That is 8% of this year's deficit, federal deficit, which is $1.8 trillion. We have $1.8 trillion deficit stretching as far as the eye can comprehend. So we're going to maybe, if we squint really hard and do bad numbers on our website, get to 8% of 1 year's of it. It's a shame. It's a missed opportunity. I think the way of thinking about Doge is that it actually should be called DOGD, the Department of Government Disruption, because I think that's more of an accurate term of what they've done. They stopped certain types of payments. We're just going to, like, you're fired tomorrow. Give us a memo of what it is that you think you do here. A lot of different stop long-term research projects. Some of these disruptions are things that I and maybe other libertarians enjoy. USAID suddenly got the rug pulled out from underneath it, maybe a little bit too rapidly, but course correction was granted. But some of them are going to be just very disruptive and not necessarily very productive. And they're going to sow all kinds of backlash and opposition to it in a way that doesn't necessarily make the government run more efficiently. It is just a sort of a punch in the mouth of the establishment, the way that it has gone on autopilot forever. Maybe they needed a punch or a slap or a tweak, but didn't make the government more efficient. As far as I can see so far, I'm still holding out hope that there will be some surprise that I'm currently unaware of. But I'd be shocked, because none of the people that we all know who have been working on making the government work more efficiently and smaller for decades, are any of those people in Doge? I don't think they are.
It's not just that they're not in Doge, it's that the Doge isn't talking to them and Doge isn't responding to questions from people who want to help out. And this is actually a note in the New York Times piece. So this is not that Doge did not respond to questions sent in a direct message on X, which is basically the only way that the Doge team will communicate at all here, right? Yeah. The White House also declined to answer detailed questions about the reductions target, though a spokesman, I guess, did tell the New York Times last week that the $1 trillion goal was still in effect. Nick, do you have any hope that Doge will actually result in $1 trillion in savings at this point?
I mean, I want to believe, I want to believe in extraterrestrials, too. Sadly, Doge is a great idea. The idea of increasing or enforcing efficiency at the government in the government is great. Matt has talked previously about how, it's important when these opportunities are created, and we should give Trump and the Trump administration credit for we're having this conversation because he won. But there is a limited, you get a limited couple swings at the pinata, and they're blowing it with this type of thing. Al Gore's Reinventing Government initiative that was done under Bill Clinton, after about a decade or so, had saved about $137 billion and had reduced the federal workforce. It put into place some significant savings, but ultimately the way that you enforce government efficiency is by capping the amount of money that the government spends, which has not been happening. Government spending continues to increase, and there is every indication that Trump is going to blow out the budget even more than he did with the continuing resolution that he forced on the Republican Party. I mean, he's talking about a $1 trillion defense budget and things like that. So I'm annoyed and frustrated, and I worry that, this is the type of thing. It's like Halley's Comet. It comes around, once every 100 years. And if you don't get it right, you got to wait for the next shot. And I think we're blowing it here.
Mary Catherine, I just want to go back to this sort of transparency question. Elon Musk talks a big game about transparency, but then when friendly people, not just the New York Times, ask questions, you don't get straightforward answers. And I think, if I want to make a defense of this, it's that they are rightfully skeptical, sort of hesitant to talk to a media that they view as fundamentally not trustworthy, as not on their side, as folks that are going to go after them, twist their words. At the same time, they are not giving the public useful and true information. How do you process this? And especially how do you process this as somebody who's kind of been inside and around some of the kind of mainstream and legacy media ecosystems that they are distrustful of?
Yeah, I want to be optimistic about this as well. I think you've got a bunch of smart people involved who are not executing necessarily as well as they should be. I think the messaging attempt that they made doing the sit-down interview with Bret Baier was a much more optimistic and palatable message for the Americans outside of those who just want the punch in the mouth to the establishment, which I'm kind of on that team. I'm fine with a punch in the mouth, but I would like it to be sustainable. So then you have to explain yourself. I think like daily press conferences with those like relatively somber sounding technologists would be something that I would show up for and listen to and talk about instead of just random tweets about things that end up not being totally true in the end. I do think
they have all of these smart nerds. They should let the smart nerds explain what they are doing if it is something that they believe is actually good and useful.
Yes. And the thing is, too, there was the freak out about this. It was like, this isn't allowed. You can't do any of this. And I think American voters rightly, and I think Trump rightly says, no, you're not allowed to tell us that we're not allowed to look at the books here. I think the best thing you can get out of Doge is a better understanding of how badly all these systems are run. And it was done kind of smartly in the executive order authorized under the U.S. Digital Service, which was already charged with doing some of this modernization. Now, that liberal view and those technologists and those smart nerds were viewed as revolutionary and wonderful by the media because they were trying to do something under the Obama administration. It was simply the difference in voter identification that was the problem, or party identification. So I understand why they're skeptical of telling people what they're doing. But those guys, they had talking about it, were good communicators. I would like to hear more from them. They seem trustworthy. And this project is worthy. And just even changing like the systems by which they do things. They're like, oh, there's a 70-year-old system for technology at the Social Security office. Maybe we should change that. Maybe that would pay dividends. And then the last part about Doge that makes me mad is when people are like, oh, this is chump change. Yes, it is a smaller number, but to most Americans who've never seen $200,000, $1 million in one place, you tell them that $150 billion of their money doesn't matter. I hate that argument. It matters because every dollar should be spent as respectfully as possible to those people who are working their jobs.
Yeah, so I have come to think of DOGE as actually having some interesting overlap with another political argument that is happening right now, which is about the abundance agenda. Sorry, Matt Welch. Just make the face. It's going to happen, right? So the big argument, or one of the big arguments for the abundance agenda, is that Democrats blew it by not delivering on their promises. They couldn't build housing or trains or anything people wanted. They couldn't govern. They were taking all that tax money and wasting it. And this has caused distrust in liberal governance. And Dems need to own up to that distrust, right? They need to sort of say, we messed up, in order to regain that trust. This is what the abundance agenda folks are arguing. And so my concern is that something similar is going to happen with DOGE, that government cutting, limited government is going to get a bad reputation. Because it doesn't deliver, because it isn't transparent, because it doesn't answer questions, because it engages in self-serving smoke and mirrors and chicanery, and it promises itself to be. And when you do that for a long time, you lose the trust of people. And I worry right now that the limited government cause is actually not being served by DOGE, simply because DOGE is not answering the questions. DOGE is not telling people what it's doing and making a case for itself in a clear and transparent way. Okay, so we're now going to move on to our final segment. This is our cultural recommendations, where our panelists discuss books, movies, TV shows, museums, podcasts, various what have yous that they have been consuming in the cultural realm recently. Nick Gillespie, what do you have for us this week?
So I'm recommending the works of Mario Vargas Llosa, the winner of the 2010 Nobel Prize in Literature, Peruvian born. Who died over the weekend. He was cited by the Nobel Prize Committee for his cartography of structures of power and his trenchant images of the individual's resistant revolt, and then, because he's a Latin American writer, and defeat. He has a shelf full of books that are fascinating, and his early novel, The Time of the Hero, which came out in 1963, was part of what was called the Latin American boom that included people like Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who was a very close friend of his, and who they split very acrimoniously over politics, and particularly the treatment of political prisoners under Castro. Vargas Llosa, eventually, he became a classical liberal, a libertarian. It shows in his work, his novels, as well as his memoir, among others, called A Fish in the Water. He wrote a couple of pieces that got published at Reason, and they are fantastic because they are a serious attempt to defend the individual against arbitrary rule and giant systems of power and oppression. He wrote a piece for us that was published in 2001 called, right around all of the discussion of globalization, called Global Village or Global Pillage. And it was a defense of globalization, of free markets, of what was then being called neoliberalism. And he talked about how he's never met a neoliberal. You're either a liberal or you're not, but there's nothing new about it. And it's one of his later works was called The Feast of the Goat, which is a terrifying kind of portrait of a leader of a small country in Latin America that will become immediately relevant to anybody who is living in contemporary America. But Mario Vargas Llosa is the type of public intellectual who is a serious, incredible writer who also engaged in the real world. I mean, he ran for the presidency of Peru after a particularly dark period there, and almost won. But so I recommend the works of Mario Vargas Llosa, starting with that 2001 essay that he wrote for Reason.
Mary Catherine?
I'm going to give you two choices for Easter / Passover week, one very silly and cynical and one earnest.
I know which one I'm choosing.
The Righteous Gemstones, especially first season.
What's the funny one?
Oh, yeah. Very nice. Danny McBride is my bard, the North Carolina man.
How has he not been canceled?
God, I love him so much.
Yeah, he's incredible.
That stupid, obscene show makes me laugh out loud multiple times per episode, particularly the first season. It's raunchy, it's gross, but you know, it deals with like, you know, the problems with organized religion and temptation and all these things in a context of religion. And then my earnest choice is The Prince of Egypt, which is the DreamWorks animated film, which is absolutely beautiful. The cast is great. It features Val Kilmer as Moses, RIP, one of my favorite actors of all time, maybe my favorite actor of all time. The music is fantastic. I mean, the pop version of the song, the main song in that was done by Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston in a duet, and the rest of the songs stand up to that. It's just fantastic. It's a beautiful piece of art. And I recommend it for this week.
That, by the way, I remember seeing that in the theater with my kids when it came out, and it was widely discussed in the left-wing press as a kind of Zionist fuck you, because it was the first animated DreamWorks SKG,
right,
which was Spielberg, Katzenberg, and David Geffen, two people who were anti-Zionists.
The Crossing of the Red Sea sequence is fantastic.
So beautiful.
Still holds up. You can get the whales in the water, and it's so much better than Ridley Scott. And I'd say this as somebody who loves Ridley Scott. So much better than Ridley Scott gave us in the awful Exodus, Gods and Kings. Matt Welch,
so speaking of great songs and Nobel Prize winners, I went to the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. This is the place where is the repository of his papers, which he donated in 2016. The museum opened in 2022. It's in this little cute, like downtown area of Tulsa. It's right next to the Woody Guthrie Center. Woody Guthrie famously was Dylan's original inspiration muse. Lovely, like perfectly sized museum. Like you're going to have a nice hour or 90 minutes there. Two floors, big kind of video room, sort of doing like 360 degree documentary footage of him, and watch and sit through that for as long as you want. And stupid tour jackets from 1985. And also a very nice little kind of selection on most of his classic records and little tidbits of information. Contents of his wallet from 1966 with like Johnny Cash's phone number. Just a cool little museum in a cool little town, bigger than little town in Tulsa, and hang around that area. Some fantastic sort of restaurants and bars and other things. Just very pleasant, lovely. Nick would love it if he hasn't been there already. I highly recommend it. Super great. And I was fortunate enough to go there in the morning, and that evening I saw Bob Dylan play live in Tulsa. So that was an extra added bonus. There's a lot of
Could
lot of
you
Bob
understand
cats.
Any of the songs that
I
he
could.
Was singing as he was singing them?
I could. Because I've recently been doing deep dives on his thing. Sometimes it would take a
Did
while.
Did it require AI for you to understand?
Could be. I wasn't ready for the sort of bossa nova treatment of when I paint my masterpiece, but whatever, like, you know, love wins.
That sounds good.
Yeah, it was really good.
Matt, if you get a chance, check out 1987 Hearts of Fire with Bob Dylan, Fiona, the English songstress, and Rupert Everett. It is the bottom of the barrel, and his barrel is, you know, many, many his sub levels deep.
His Hearts cinematic barrel is
it is so good,
very
so
very
good, hard to find.
Deeply awful. Yes.
Bob Dylan hate and Danny McBride hate in one.
Oh, I love Bob Dylan. To love him, to know him is to love him and hate him.
All right. Speaking of the 1980s, I've been watching a superhero show, Daredevil: Born Again. You're all very surprised about this. You should
Christian
be surprised because
Daredevil.
I actually have not watched a superhero television show in a couple of years at this point. I'm kind of mostly tuned out to the Disney's Marvel universe, at least on the TV side. I've watched all the movies, but went back and watched this. The reviews were pretty good. It's a follow-up to the Netflix series that ran in the 2010s for a couple of years, and they've sort of revived it and brought back the characters and are reintegrating it into the MCU in a more formal and explicit way. And it's kind of fascinating because it brings Trump-era politics to a superhero show and positions Wilson Fisk, who is played by Vincent D'Onofrio, he is the supervillain known as the Kingpin, positions him as a sort of Trump-like figure who has won the election for mayor of New York City and is determined to bring back the rule of law and stand up for the working man. And so there's this great little bit in one of the early episodes where he's like traveling in his SUV and he has to stop and he gets out and it turns out there's a giant pothole in the road. And the construction guys are like, you know what? We can't fix this because all the red tape and it's just a mess. And he's just like, you're going to fix this right now. And they're like, well, who on whose authority? And like, there's all this bureaucracy, right? And he's like, on the authority of the mayor. That's it, right? And then he like is like, hey, I get things done. And this is what you elected me to do. And so it's this actually kind of interesting transposition of a bunch of today's political debates. A big part of the argument that Fisk makes for his mayoral candidacy is you can't have vigilantes running around in costumes beating the crap out of people. That's not justice. That's not the rule of law. Well, it turns out the police are also doing some stuff that does not fall under the category of the rule of law. Maybe they are also right. And so there's this fascinating tension between like, do we want a daredevil type figure who is taking the law into his own hands? Or do we want that to be run through the police who are maybe also not entirely credible here? Or do we want this to run through a mayor who is on the one hand getting some stuff done? And on the other hand, the head of a vast criminal empire.
I don't know, guys. Was actually the first abundance Democrat.
That's right. I think it would be better if... This is defund the police. This is, you got to clean up the subways. And right, because the first big trial is about something that, some subway crime that like, was this a vigilante doing this against bad cops? Or is this good cops who have like, who were harmed by a vigilante who's actually an evil guy? Like kind of interesting questions brought into the superhero realm.
I wish that instead of being Wilson Fisk, that the Kingpin was Carlton Fisk.
Mm.
I think that would add another layer for the sports fans.
Between
there.
The cheek and gum.
Pudge.
We're just going to have to take this back to the mid-aughts blogging and Fisk this entire segment. Yeah. Remember that, folks? Remember this was a thing that people did in their lives for a lot of years?
Yeah, what was the name of the guy? Robert Fisk.
Robert Fisk.
He was the pro-terror columnist for some British publication or something.
So you would Fisk it and do a close reading.
That's right. Mm. All right. So that's our show. Before we go, Nick, do you have any announcements for us? Events you want to tease?
I've got two upcoming debates. Go to reason.com/events, or two events. On April 26th, if you are in New Hampshire, there's going to be a Soho Forum debate with Eric Brakey, who's the head of the Free State Project, a former very effective state senator from Maine who is now heading up the Free State Project, versus Reason's own Andrew Heaton. I have no idea what they're going to be talking about, but it should be interesting. And if you're in New Hampshire, let's face it, there's probably not anything else going on. So April 26th. Back in New York, on May 6th, I'm going to be doing a Reason Speakeasy, a live taping of the Reason interview with Robert Rosenkrantz, who is a billionaire businessman. He's the founder of Open to Debate, and he's got a new book out called The Stoic Capitalist, which is a very good read. So come out on May 6th. But then on May 21st, we've got a Soho Forum debate back here in New York, Dave Smith versus Alex Narasso of the Cato Institute on immigration and how should libertarians think about immigration. That's on May 21st. But again, go to reason.com/events and hopefully we'll see you all there.
Before we go, then, we just want to say thank you to some of our stoic capitalists. Give a big shout out to some generous supporters. Mark Brimmer, Bob O'Donovan, Andrew Wimsatt, Andrew Winner, Andy Rotter, Greg Hamer, Kevin Toomey, Melanie Banfield. Thank you, Melanie. Thank you all so much for making this podcast and everything we do at Reason possible. Thank you, Mary Catherine Hamm, for joining us.
Clap, ably.
Defending the honor of Bojangles and so many other things. As always, if you like this podcast, Herschel Walker, you're responsible for all of this somehow or another. If you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you so much for listening. Like John Wick, the Reason Roundtable will return.